Hello, I'm Kyle Willoughby. Joining me is Claire White.
Hello.
And this is Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerdman. We're here to discuss new nerd creations, how they're made, and explore the roots of the characters and the stories. Today we're talking about Rogue One, this brand new Star Wars film that just came out. It's the 8th Star Wars film released ever. It came out on December 16th, and it focuses on the rebels who steal the plans to the Death Star.
Which gets blown up
in A New Hope,
right?
The original Star Wars film. We also have a special guest with us today, Nicole Davis.
Woo!
Yay! Nicole is on a podcast called Geek Cinema Society. Nicole, what do you guys do on Geek Cinema Society?
We look at movies that are considered essential to geek culture as determined by a crowdsourced and ranked list. And each week we have on a guest who's never seen the movie until the week before the podcast. So we always have at least one fresh perspective on the film.
And it's a really great podcast. I urge you guys to check it out. We're going to, do Twitter and stuff at the end of it. And Nicole is going to be our kind of resident geek cinema expert for Rogue One. And she's going to be chiming in with her tidbits about the movie. I'm going to be talking about the production of the film and Gareth Edwards, the director, and how Disney just seems to buy up intellectual property like nobody's business.
Like the Empire.
And Claire will be telling us about, who are you talking about? What are you talking about?
I'm going to talk a long way around about a female spy and a female espionage, since there was a great female spy in Rogue One.
Yes, Rogue One is definitely a war / espionage film,
right?
With a female main character. So, Claire, why don't you take it away with your history of
female
espionage?
Well, I'm going to get up there in a really roundabout way, so everyone's going to have to be a little bit patient with me. So when I started looking up the history of Rogue One, I was, looking at the Star Wars movies and what they were based on, and George Lucas is a self-professed lover of history. He says while the psychological basis of Star Wars is mythological, the political and social bases are all from historical events.
Yeah.
So some of the things that I'm not going to talk about that Star Wars is based on are the Roman Empire, which I can definitely see, the Knights Templar.
Oh, really?
Yeah, Jedis.
Yeah, I guess so.
the Viet Cong. Apparently the Ewoks are the Viet Cong.
Oh, wow.
Okay.
But the Ewoks
That's
are good.
That's not vaguely racist.
the Rebels, too, are the Viet Cong, the Ewoks and the Rebels.
Okay.
And also, getting more to my point, the Empire was inspired a lot by Nazi Germany and 1970s America.
Yeah, he used old World War II, fighter films or, like, dogfight films.
Oh, yeah, definitely.
To kind of inspire the X-Wings and stuff. I remember reading that.
Yeah, well, I'm not going to talk about 1970s America, but I am going to continue on this World War II path.
Okay.
Like, an example, the Stormtroopers have the same name as the Nazi Stormtroopers. The Imperial uniforms are very similar to Nazi uniforms.
Yeah.
And Emperor Palpatine's ascent from chancellor to dictator, you could kind of mirror to Hitler's ascent to a dictator.
Yeah, I think there are a lot of similarities there, actually, which I never
thought
about.
Especially beginning with the title chancellor. That's what Hitler's original title was.
But it was Führer instead of Emperor.
Yeah.
And so we were talking about how this movie deals with espionage, and I was wondering how I could fit this into the segment, because espionage, I was looking that up too, has been around since basically the beginning of humans coming together into societies.
Yeah.
Also, the way to define espionage is the practice of spying or using spies to obtain information about the plans and activities, especially of foreign governments or competing companies. That's from Merriam-Webster. So now we know exactly what it means.
Yeah.
But for example, spies are mentioned in the Bible. I think Moses sends out 12 spies, their chieftains from each of the 12 tribes to scout out land for the Israelite people after they flee from Egypt.
Okay.
And then the writings from ancient Indian, Chinese, Greek, Egyptian, Romans, and Hebrew empires all mention spies. So they've been around for a while, and I kind of had problems about, like, where I was going to draw my, like...
Yeah, where, like,
the sources from,
Rogue One.
Because Rogue One isn't based on any particular story or battle.
No,
or...
and we started this research before seeing the movie, and it's not like that spy-y of a movie.
Right.
You know? It's not like a... I don't know.
Well, like I think this kind of works out because I just, you know, there's a female rebel kind of without a cause, Jin, the lead, and then she has a cause. So I was looking up like great female spies, and this one happened to be in World War II.
Okay.
So it works with my stormtroopers and Nazis and the Empire being Nazi Germany. Her name was Nancy Wake, and she was actually one of the Allies' most decorated service women of World War II. So I'm going to talk about her story a little bit, and, you know, the how she used espionage and then eventually was out there fighting with the French resistance. She was codenamed by the Gestapo as the White Mouse because of her ability to avoid capture, and she's super cool. She was born in New Zealand but grew up in Sydney. And then she inherited a lot of money from an aunt and used that money to travel to London, where she worked as a journalist. And it's there where she witnessed the rise of Nazism and anti-Semitism. And she kind of decided then that if she could do anything against the Nazis, she was going to help. While she was thinking that, she was living the fabulous life in Paris.
Fabulous life.
It sounds wonderful, especially because she married this incredibly wealthy French industrialist named Henri Fioca. And they, like, he just seemed to, like, dine on champagne and caviar every night is what I was reading. And during the day as well.
That does sound like fairly James Bondy of, like, this this woman just living the high life.
And having the access, too.
Yeah.
And she did use that access well. When war broke out, she actually bought and drove an ambulance and was able, because she was the wife of a wealthy industrialist, she could get into places others couldn't, and she was helping evacuate people from war zones and picking up troops and, you know, moving them to the next best spot. And then once the Nazis got into France, it was divided into two zones. There was the north, which was occupied France, and the south.
Vichy France.
Yes, Vichy France, but was still basically controlled by the Nazis.
Yeah,
they were working with them.
It was like the puppet government that the Nazis installed.
So she and her husband lived in Marseille. Which was in the south in free France. And she got involved in the resistance movement because she ran into an Englishman at a bar, and he was reading an English book at first, and she couldn't believe that someone would be so bold as to read an English book.
Yeah.
She started talking to him. She herself was part of the British Empire, and she worked out that he was an Allied officer that was being interned at Fort St. John, which also held a bunch of other Allied officers. So she befriended the men and ended up, because of her wealth, was able to supplement their rations with black market food.
Wait, where did she see? This guy was a prisoner?
Yeah, but they had leave. It was, you know, France.
Yeah.
Like, it wasn't as bad.
Yeah, the Nazis were a lot nicer to the British and the French officers and soldiers in general than they were to the Russians and the Poles and people in Eastern Europe, the Slavic people.
Yeah, it was
people.
Good to be... The best to be, I think, was British.
Yeah, British or French. But they like, saw themselves more aligned with Western
Europe. The Aryans,
Europe.
Yeah. I think some of these men were eventually shipped off to the camps in Germany. But eventually she started escorting escapees on train journeys towards the Pyrenees, where they would escape into Spain from France. And she did this for about 2.5 years, and she helped hundreds of people escape into Spain.
That's crazy.
And as the wife of a rich citizen, she could travel where others couldn't and could like take them on the first class train with her.
Yeah.
Like when you're reading this, I think it's also this like glamorization
of the war.
It's
kind of romantic
war.
Idea. Yeah.
But it sounds so fabulous.
Saving people, living the luxury life, riding first class trains to Spain.
Oh yeah, and then
it
like
sounds
one
a little sorry, I was just thinking it sounds a little Ernest Hemingway meets F. Scott Fitzgerald.
It does. It definitely does.
Yeah.
You know, like,
we haven't gotten to the battle yet. She actually ended up freeing one of the resistance leaders, who was a Scotsman, from a concentration camp by bribing a guard.
Oh, wow.
Just, like, got him out of there.
Yeah.
The Gestapo eventually noticed a dark-haired woman operating on the southern line and started looking for her, and this is where the codename the White Mouse came in, because she was just evading capture. And this is the thing, is that the German Gestapo in Paris and the German Gestapo in Marseille didn't actually work together, because each one wanted the glory of capturing the White Mouse.
Okay.
And this is how she was able to evade capture, because by the time they had compared notes, she had heard that they were looking for them and had managed to get away.
Yeah, and they would, so they wouldn't, they were like back in the day when the FBI, the CIA, NSA wouldn't.
Back in the day?
Back, they work more in tandem now, but you know, 15 years ago, 20 years ago, they were like very much competing against each other. They didn't like to share information with each other.
And even her escape just sounds just so fabulously exciting. Like, she had to try 6 times because people were intercepting people on the route. People were getting found. There was a mole.
They were intercepting, like, couriers or something?
Yes, or, like, with safe houses were getting taken.
Okay.
There was one part where she had to jump off a train, and the Germans were shooting at her. And
sounds
still...
like Indiana Jones.
I know. It sounds like a movie. Like, yeah. It actually sounds like a movie. And she finally made it into Spain and then went into London, where she was trained as a saboteur by the Special Operations Executive, or SRE. And this was formed in 1943 to work with resistant forces in German-occupied Europe. They instructed her in guns and explosives and silent killing. She learned how to identify German aircraft military vehicles, what codes meant. And they liked the idea of training women because they felt that women could get out of trouble in ways that men couldn't.
Yeah, and often overlooked, I feel like, by soldiers. You know, you're going to be looking for that sketchy dude in a trench coat, not like the cute New Zealand girl.
She did speak perfect French, so you would think she was a French girl. Yeah. A New Zealand girl in occupied France, when they're fighting the British Empire,
yeah,
I don't think would fare well.
Yeah, no, definitely not.
Okay, so... In April of 1944, they parachuted her into central France, and the plan was to build up the French resistance and the size of it, because they wanted the French resistance to sabotage the Germans to take the pressure off the eventual D-Day landing.
Yeah.
So she armed and trained men, and basically they would at night go to this field, and the British would drop weapons. And then they would distribute that to the force and use the weapons as also means to get more people to sign up.
I don't know. Nicole, did you ever watch the Agent Carter Marvel TV show?
I have not, but I have heard excellent things about it. And I certainly like Haley Atwell's portrayal in the Captain America films.
This sounds very like Haley Atwell, Agent Carter sort of thing, parachuting into France.
It is a bit. They've actually made several, you know, movies and TV movies based on her life. Probably the most famous one was Charlotte Gray.
When was that?
Kate Blanchett playing the title character. And while she's not a cute New Zealand girl, she is a cute Australian girl.
Almost as good.
When was that?
Charlotte Gray, the novel, was 1999. I'm not 100% sure about the movie.
Okay. Because when you're reading her life, you're like...
Nancy Wake, yeah.
Where is the, like...
Yeah, where's the big biopic about this? Yeah.
Yeah.
A film based on the book was produced in 2001.
Okay.
Did you see it, Nicole, or...
I haven't.
I wonder if it's any good.
I don't know, because I haven't heard anything about it.
Yeah.
But
something to check out, perhaps.
Right. So one of the most, what she thinks is like the best thing that she ever did for during the war and the resistance is that I guess a radio operator destroyed a radio because he thought that the Germans were about to intercept it. But they needed that radio for the French resistance to get a hold of London because D-Day was happening soon. So she cycled 250 miles through enemy lines. And what she did is she had a string grocery bag on her cycle.
So on her bike, right?
Right. But it was a thing that it was so transparent. It's like she wasn't hiding anything.
Yeah.
And when she would get stopped at checkpoints, she would ask the Germans if they wanted to search her. And they would think she was innocent and just, like, let her go through.
Yeah.
But she managed to make contact with the French resistance, the 250 miles away, or I guess 125 miles away, and then got Britain to promise to drop a radio on their next drop, and then had to cycle all the way back.
Biked back.
And apparently on the main roads, too, just, like, going through.
That's so insane.
Yeah.
And then this... It's like an Iron Man or something.
Yeah, she said afterwards she was so sore. And then this is where her life, again, becomes more like Jin's, where she spent a lot of the rest of the war ambushing German convoys, destroying bridges and railway lines. She was part of a raid that destroyed Gestapo headquarters. She was there throwing in grenades.
Jin being the main character of Rogue One.
Played by Felicity Jones.
Yeah.
Also, she killed a man with a judo chop to stop him from alerting other Germans to their presence. And apparently this was something they trained them for when she was training with the SRE. And she said she did it and didn't realize that it actually, like, would work.
That's so crazy.
But anyway, the sad
part. It's not something you really think will work in real life. It sounds good. It looks awesome in the movies.
Yeah,
but you have your doubts.
When Sean Connery as James Bond, you know, judo chops people, like looking now, it's like that would never work.
It's like, well, they make
or
fun
William
of it.
Shatner on Star Trek.
Yeah, or William Shatner.
But they make fun of it in Austin Powers, like the judo chop.
Yeah, that's
judo
right,
chop.
They do.
Judo chop. Because it just sounds so crazy.
It's cool. Like, I mean, cool. It's crazy to think of this, you know, woman killing a Nazi Gestapo officer with her bare hands.
Mm-hmm.
Like, that's.
Yeah. No, she was a. That's
pretty,
why she was the
pretty
most decorated.
Badass. Yeah.
Women are capable of amazing things, Kyle.
I know. I'm sorry. And I know that. I know that.
Do you? No, I know he does. Her husband, unfortunately, was actually tortured and killed not long after she left Marseille, and she found that out after the war.
Oh, really?
But he was supposed to meet her in London and never
and
got
never
back.
Never did. Oh, yeah. That's really sad. That's when the fabulous life doesn't seem so
fabulous
anymore.
Well, then the fabulous
anymore.
Life stopped because yeah. No more money. And...
Were they trying to get, like, info out of him or something?
Uh-huh, about her.
And he wouldn't give it up?
No. Trooper.
That's so sad.
But anyway, that's kind of the story of Nancy Wake. She's super fascinating. And I thought it was a fun little tie-in to, like, this, you know, female character.
Yeah,
who,
this badass chick who's...
You know, was eventually able to lead... help lead the French Resistance.
Yeah.
Not that she was, like, the top leader, but she was definitely a huge part of it.
Yeah. Just the idea of parachuting into France in 1943.
Yeah.
Like, that's a really
44.
Cool image. Or 1944, still.
Excuse me.
It's just...
1944.
it's just a really cinematic image.
Yeah, and apparently she got stuck in a tree when she parachuted in.
I think I read something about that, and some French resistance officer was like, the trees in France bear beautiful fruit this time of year. And she was like, shut up,
that's
you bastard.
So cheesy.
Yeah.
I think she said, stop it with that French shit.
Yeah, she
oh,
said,
excuse
stop
me.
It with that. What a
that
boss,
that was a direct
man.
Quote.
Yeah, that was a Nancy Wake quote.
So that's my little history fun spy segment. Kyle, I want to hear about how this was made.
It's pretty interesting, actually. There's a lot to talk about when a movie's being made. Like, there's so much that goes into it and so many hands. I kind of wanted to start, just because we've never done a Star Wars anything before on our podcast, I wanted to go back a little bit and talk about Disney actually acquiring LucasArts.
No, I'm very interested in this.
And then talk a little bit about Gareth Edwards, who's the director. So yeah, I'm going to go back to the beginning. Disney buying Lucasfilm. Actually, it's not LucasArts, it's Lucasfilm. It's George Lucas's company. And when they bought Lucasfilm, they got his special effects company as well, Industrial Light and Magic, which they use all the time now for their special effects. And they also got the intellectual properties of Indiana Jones and Star Wars. So...
Oh, are they going to make more? They are making more Indiana Jones movies, aren't they?
I guess. Expect some Disney Indiana Jones movies in the future, I bet. I'm kind of, like, sad and excited at the same time.
I'm just sad.
Because Disney, you know, Disney makes, are making solid movies, but they do feel a little empty, like a little soulless at times. I don't know. Or maybe it's just, like, it's starting to wear on me, kind of the mass-produced McDonald's sort of Disney film, which is satisfying, but still, I don't know. It's not the same as some kooky film student in 1977 trying to get his weird space movie made, which was the original Star Wars. So Lucas, when he sold to Disney, he's kind of gone back and forth on like whether or not it was a good idea, which makes sense. And he describes it as breaking up with a girlfriend. You know, sometimes you want them to be happy, you know, out on their own, but other times you want them to be miserable. And you want their movies to suck. Where sometimes you want to, like, be a part of their life and, like, have input and, you know, be there for them. Other times you're like, look, I just got to let this go. Because in the Force Awakens, he had given Disney his ideas for the Force Awakens, like the next three movies. No. They were like, nope, you can get out of here, George. And he was like, and he even said himself in an interview, he was like, look, I knew like if I tried to stay there, I would just be getting in the way and causing problems. I don't know, you feel kind of bad for him. Even after
I don't know. Not after what he did with the prequels.
Not after the prequels.
So bad.
Yeah.
About them shooing him out of the room.
Go, George, we saw what you did last with Star Wars films, and you are not touching this. But it is his creation. I don't know. I do feel bad
for the
guy.
I would feel sad if it was mine. I mean, I guess he has $4 billion. I can't be that sad.
Yeah. So that
that's probably comforting at
yeah,
night.
Yeah, somewhat. If every time I broke up with a girlfriend, I got $4 billion. the breakup wouldn't be so bad. But which leads me to my next little aside. You know, Disney acquired Star Wars in 2012 for $4 billion. Star Wars being a Lucasfilm, acquired all of Lucasfilm in 2012. For $4 billion. And normally, after such a huge acquisition, a company's stock would take kind of a hit because the company has less, you know, money in the bank. They just paid out $4 billion, so the stock goes down a little bit. Normally, such a big acquisition is a huge risk because you don't know if you can get a return on that investment.
No one doubted that return.
Yeah. This was not the case for Disney. Just 4 days after they bought Lucasfilm, Disney's stock was shooting up higher and higher. And, They bought it in 2012, and they were predicted by now that their stock would have increased by about 50%, when actually it's doubled in value. It's increased by 100%.
Because of Star Wars.
I'm sure the stockholders are very happy about that.
They are extremely happy, but weirdly, they're getting nervous now because they've had so much success. They're starting to get a little, apparently, the shareholders are starting to get a little nervous.
That something's just going to happen?
Yeah, that something's going to happen, or they're not going to be able to keep up this pace of excellence as far as money-making goes. But one of the reasons cited for why Disney stock didn't take a hit after they bought Lucasfilms was because they've taken part in much riskier acquisitions previously to mad success.
Like what?
Disney bought Marvel in 2009, also for $4 billion, and people thought that was going to be
they
a
bad... They bought Marvel for $4 billion?
$4 billion, yeah, same amount as Lucasfilm.
I don't think Marvel is worth as much as Star Wars.
I mean...
Kyle just shrugged. We can't hear the shrug.
You can't hear, yeah, you guys can't hear the shrug, but I shrugged. I mean, I don't know.
They got a big stable of characters over at Marvel that they can draw from.
They do.
So does Star Wars.
They have a
though.
Big stable of characters. They have comics, which don't make a lot of money, but, you know, make
but
some money.
They inspire so much love.
They inspire so much love. And you know what Marvel also has is merchandise, like Star Wars, though.
But Star Wars does, too.
Yeah. So anyway, yeah.
I'm telling you, you're wrong.
You're wrong. No. Well, maybe Marvel got a good price from them. Maybe Disney was like, we'll give you $3 billion. And they were like, make it four. And Disney's like, all right.
make it five. And then they wheedled them down to four.
Yeah, maybe. So that was their last big acquisition, which was super risky and has clearly paid off for Disney. And also in 2006, they bought Pixar for $9 billion.
What?
Which people thought was also a really risky acquisition, which has clearly paid off.
Disney, like, the money they have. Like, I know they have money.
Yeah.
That's, like, it's not a surprise.
Yeah.
They pick good, solid properties. I mean, in 2004, they bought the rights to The Muppets and The Bear in the Big Blue House show from the Jim Henson Company.
I forgot they had Muppets, too.
Right.
Well, now they can use the Muppets in Star Wars.
They could. Well, they're on an acquisition hot streak. And I think it's notable to point out that Disney has set an industry record right now for having four $1 billion-plus movies in their last fiscal year. And let me tell you what those movies were. It was The Force Awakens, was a $1 billion-plus movie. It was Captain America: Civil War, also made over $1 billion. It was Finding Dory, and it was Zootopia. So three of those four things that made them over $1 billion were from acquisitions in the past 10 years.
Isn't Zootopia Pixar?
No, Zootopia wasn't Pixar. It was just under the Disney umbrella.
Well, then that wouldn't be from an acquisition, right?
Maybe. I mean, probably. But as far as, like, the three big ones...
Just a technicality.
Yeah. As far as the three big ones, you know, Star Wars, Marvel, and Pixar, they're still paying off for Disney extremely well. Like, Pixar still makes them a ton of money, and Marvel's going to be apparently making the money into forever.
Yeah, and Star Wars will, too.
Yeah, and so will Star Wars. So, you know, they make these big investments, big payoffs. I'm going to switch... Now, and talk a little bit about Gareth Edwards, who directed Rogue One. Now, Edwards is the most recent kind of young indie film director that Disney has tapped for its own purposes. You were the one talking about that in the, right. Was it in the Civil War episode, right, Claire?
I think it was. I don't know if you heard this, Nicole, but basically Disney has this thing where they will just pick a director that they like and enjoy working with, and they don't care about the experience because they have experience.
Yeah.
So instead of picking, like, Steven Spielberg to direct Star Wars, which would be so cool, but instead of doing that and having to pay Spielberg all this money and maybe bow down to their ambitions, yeah. they just kind of are like, oh, no, you have a cool idea.
Yeah.
We'll run with you. And we can show you how to do everything. In fact, we'll do everything.
Yeah.
You just do little directing here and there.
They take these,
don't worry your pretty little head about
it. Yeah, don't worry. We've got all the money and all the things you need. Don't worry. Yeah, so they'll just grab these indie directors, give them everything they ever wished for, and have them make their movie. But
you can make a Star Wars movie.
Yeah, exactly. But,
oh, but that makes it so much more exciting.
It does.
Than having either a journeyman director, you know, yeah. somebody who can do the job but might not be the best at it,
yeah.
Or somebody who's been around for a million years and does not need the work. You
yeah.
know, pick somebody who's new.
Who cares?
I think it's fantastic. You know, yeah. I'm really looking forward to, say, Rian Johnson's take on episode 8. And
yeah,
see
me
how that
too.
Works.
I'm hoping that. Well, we'll get to that later. But yeah, I'm looking forward to that as well because I do like Rian Johnson. So Edwards has only done two other feature film movies before this.
Oh my gosh. Imagine that you have only done
two
movies,
other movies.
And they're like, would you like to direct Star Wars?
Well, feature films. He's done other stuff, but yeah, yeah, you're right.
Do you say yes, please, or yes. Oh my God, I don't think so.
No, that's the question.
Everyone will hate me.
His first feature, which kind of put him on the map, was Monsters. Came out in 2010, and it was kind of in the indie film circuit, and it was a fairly popular like indie sci-fi film because there weren't a lot of those. And I have seen that movie. It was on Netflix ages ago, and I remember watching it. And it's a cool movie. I didn't realize it was him.
What movie
is
that?
Guy. It's called Monsters. It's about these huge beasts that kind of invade Earth, and it's kind of shot documentary style. It's very nitty gritty, and this couple who are kind of traveling through, filming like the monsters, you know, attacking in different places on Earth. It's set mostly in Mexico. Then the movie did after that, which goes in line with Monsters, was 2014's Godzilla.
With Bryan Cranston, right?
Yeah, yeah, with Bryan Cranston, which I have not seen. You guys see that?
Have you seen it, Nicole? I haven't seen it.
I have.
And
I quite liked it. I quite liked it. It was a little overly coy about showing the monster. You know, you see it on TV screens first, and then you
yeah.
see just a foot, and
yeah.
then, you know, just bits and pieces of it until the end, you know, like the last 20 minutes, and then you get to see everything, and it's awesome.
Yeah, yeah.
Because it got really
good reviews, right?
Liked it. The reviews were mixed, but that was one of the complaints, is that, like, you never get to see Godzilla.
The human performances weren't great.
Oh, really? Godzilla was fine.
Olsen was really good, but Aaron Taylor Johnson could have used a little more coaching.
Oomph.
Maybe it was working with the special effects that were a problem for him. I don't know.
Yeah. Cranston originally didn't want to do it, but Gareth Edwards sent him the script and really wanted him, and Bryan Cranston was like, all right, this kid really wants me, and the script's okay. He didn't want to be in, like, a bad, who is it, Matthew Broderick Godzilla movie.
Oh,
you know,
And
it clearly...
So it did really well in theaters, though, didn't it, Godzilla?
Yeah, Godzilla did well in theaters. It made money. And it was actually under Warner Brothers, who's Disney's kind of archenemy.
Who Disney is just killing.
I don't know about archenemy, but like maybe less successful little brother at this point.
We talk a lot about like the Marvel DC kind of
rivalry.
Back and forth, and just
yeah.
how Marvel just seems to be killing
yeah.
DC every step of the way.
Yeah. Yeah. At least in cinematic universes.
Yes. Not in the comics.
But you know, Disney saw Godzilla and obviously liked it because they wanted Edwards to do Rogue One. And I read a Vulture interview with Edwards, and he says he had planned on taking a break right after Godzilla. Like, he's like, I just don't want to make another movie. I just want to, like, relax for a little bit. Thinking that Disney wouldn't be releasing another Star Wars film for a while, because, you know, the original Star Wars films were released 3 years apart. And he's like, if they want me for a movie, I've got time. But as soon as Godzilla was over, they were like, yep, get over here. We need you to direct this Star Wars movie.
So they just went after him? They didn't interview people or?
Well, he had thought that they were going after a bunch of people and he wasn't the only one to get this email. But it turns out like he was one of the only people to be approached to direct Rogue One by Disney.
I'm not even a director. I don't want to be a director, but that's kind of my dream.
Yeah, that Disney would approach you.
That someone would be like, can you make this Star Wars? We think you're the best.
And he said, like, he wanted to take a break, and he said he would have turned any other movie down, but it's Star Wars. And it's the original Star Wars was the reason he wanted to make films. So he's like, well, the only reason I'm doing this is because it's Star Wars. And he thought that if they gave this movie to another director because he turned it down and he saw it and it's not his vision. And he knew he had the chance to make it. He would have been so sad and just depressed. So he went right from Godzilla into Rogue One. And Edwards cites George Lucas, Steven Spielberg, and Quentin Tarantino as his kind of biggest directorial influences. And like I said, it's just the original Star Wars is why he wanted to make movies to begin with. For Rogue One, he really wanted to make a Star Wars movie, like wars and emphasis. And I think that comes across
in the film itself.
Yeah. And he wanted to make it gritty and down to earth and, you know, less force magic and princesses and more like grunts on the ground, kind of getting mistreated.
Not the chosen one.
Not the chosen ones, exactly. Yeah. And one of the first things Edwards did to show the aesthetic and feel he was going for with the movie was he took photos from Vietnam, World War II, and the recent conflicts in the Middle East, and he photoshopped Star Wars, you know, rebel uniforms under the people into them, and he, like, replaced Humvees with, and tanks with, you know, X-Wings and other Star Wars technology.
I kind of feel like that's the original Star Wars spirit, though. Like, when you see that, you know, A New Hope, I remember reading, because, you know, you watch it as a kid and you just take it for granted. I saw it when I was five. But, like, that it was so crazy that this sci-fi movie was gritty.
Yeah.
That, like, the ship looked, like, the spaceship looked like it had been around the block a few times.
Yeah.
Yes.
The X-Wings, yeah.
It's a nice touch. It's a lived-in world.
Yeah, yeah, and it is a little dirty. And how George Lucas used dogfight films from World War II to help influence, like, how he was making the X-Wings, you know, fight in space. So this is a good callback to that Edwards was looking at these old war photos and photoshopping in Star Wars stuff onto them to get, like, the feel that he wanted. I think that is a good callback to the original Star Wars. And for me, I think it showed through pretty well in the film. And he, you know, this is what he kind of presented to Disney as his take. And Disney was like, yeah, that looks great. And he kept waiting for them to fire him, he says. Like that all I can show them are these like, Photoshop films. And it's like, they're not going to use me anymore. But no, they were down with it. He also mentions the pivotal 1966 film, The Battle of Algiers, as a big influence on what he wanted this movie to evoke. And The Battle of Algiers, for those of you who didn't know, came out around the time that Algeria was a French colony, and Algiers was the capital of Algeria, and there was a big kind of terrorist fight between Algerians who were trying to throw off French colonialization and the French military, which was like kind of fresh out of World War II and were these really tough dudes who weren't going to put up with anything, and it was a propaganda film for the Algerians, essentially.
Right.
If you haven't seen Battle of Algiers, it's one of the most pivotal films of the last 100 years. I really suggest you check it out. And it also evokes a lot, or you can see Rogue One evoking a lot from Algiers.
Now, see, I would have thought it would be more. It's so similar in theme to movies like The Guns of Navarone, The Dirty Dozen, Where Eagles Dare. They're sort of World War II movies that involve a special team with a specific mission to retrieve or destroy a specific enemy asset, whether it's a person or key intelligence or an important outpost.
Yeah.
It reminded me of a film that I have seen, Bridge on the River Kwai.
Yeah.
In which a collaborator by default kind of helps create and then inspire the destruction of an asset like that.
Yeah. No, I agree with you that this film is reminiscent of River Kwai. But I never saw Garth
You know,
Edwards
I think those
that.
Stories are also so popular. Like, the idea of that is so appealing that you, like, against the odds, like,
yeah,
the small group of people.
Yeah,
yeah, yeah. Now, as for there's a reshoot controversy going on with this movie where the film went into reshoots and people were saying like, oh, it's going to be another Suicide Squad thing where the studio is, you know, going to come in and kind of dictate how the movie was made. According to Edwards, he says that's not how it was at all. What the way Edwards shot the film was he had multiple bunches and bunches of cameras for every scene, and he would shoot at all these different angles. And then he would take all that footage and kind of cherry pick what he liked the best. And that helped give it the gritty feel and kind of give it like the big scale, help make the AT-AT walkers look really big and stuff in it. And so he would go through all that footage, see what he liked. And, you know, sometimes he liked the footage, but thought like, okay, if we're going to use this angle, we can shoot this better. And so that's why there was a bunch of, you know, numerous reshoots on this film. It wasn't because Disney hated his direction, apparently, according to him. It was because of the way he shot the film initially to get it all gritty. And as far as facts and figures, just to say how well this movie's been doing, Rogue One's estimated budget was $200 million, and it's projected to make over $150 million its opening weekend, which is this weekend. So it's, you know, it's doing
well. It's getting
there. It's getting there. It has an 84% critic score on Rotten Tomatoes and a 90% audience score on Rotten Tomatoes. So people like it. Critics largely like it.
Generally like it, yeah.
Yeah. But the real question, screw the critics and the people, do we like it? The three of us. You're our geek cinema expert. What do you think?
I liked it. I only just saw it about 6 hours ago.
Yeah, you're pretty fresh.
So I'm still sort of processing it.
Reeling from
I mean, overall, it is just visually, it's gorgeous.
Yeah.
Absolutely gorgeous. There's some amazing shots. I won't get too specific, but there are scenes of destruction that are weirdly beautiful.
Yeah.
You know, and like you said, they make the AT-ATs look really humongous, and it looks fantastic. Almost everything, and I think we're going to get to it. Almost everything looks real.
Yeah. No, I agree. I think the space battles in this were some of the best space battles in Star Wars at all.
And the performances are some of the best performances I've seen.
Yeah. Claire, what about you? What are your initial thoughts on it?
So Star Wars is complicated for me because the... No, listen.
I have a deep, dark history with Star Wars.
It's complicated.
I'm going to give you a small number of details.
Views of relationship.
Kind of. So the first three, not the like 1, 2, 3.
Yeah, not episode
but like
one, two,
New
three.
Hope, Empire Strikes Back, Return of the Jedi. Those are my favorite movies.
The real movies.
They're the best. They are my favorite, like, just like for happiness throughout my life, especially as a child. Like I have watched those more times than I can count.
I
feel like it's this thing, especially with these new Disney releases, like the prequels I don't even count, but like these Disney releases, they play these trailers and they're so like nostalgic and exciting, and I'm going in there for that feeling again, like that. And I just don't think I'm gonna ever get that again from a Star Wars
movie.
You're
not a kid anymore. Yeah,
I'm not a kid.
Yeah.
I know this. Like, I feel like I go in knowing my expectations are unreal, but you can't put me in that world and, like, make me, like,
kinda
I can't
not
enjoy
compare it.
I'm not going to enjoy it the same way. And I'm one of those people that I wish that, like, Lucas had just sat on the rights and then, like, never sold them, never made anything. Because I think those first three movies are so wonderful. Like, I never read, as much as I love them, and I read a bunch of nerdy stuff when I was a kid, I never read any of the Star Wars books because they didn't want those movies ruined.
Oh, wow.
So, like, I acknowledge, like, I had a good time in the movie. Like, I did. I had a good time. I thought some of the dialogue was a little bit clunky, and some of the plot points I just didn't think were as earned as some other things. But I did have a good time, and it did play on my emotions of some of the nostalgic stuff. But I just wish there was never another Star Wars movie ever.
That's it. You just want case closed. Like, close the door and
Star Wars. This is perfect. Why are you ruining a perfect thing?
Yeah.
I used to feel that way about it. I mean, certainly the prequels soured me quite a bit on it. I mean, I don't think they're uniformly horrible. There's some good things in each of them.
Yeah.
But overall, they're really poorly, you know, so many of the lines land flatly and they're silly and overwrought in a lot of places. But I mean, I was even though I see the points about The Force Awakens being, you know, kind of manipulative and echoing a lot of the beats of Episode 4, I still really enjoyed the heck out of that, especially the actors that they found, you know, the performances, the total charm of Daisy Ridley and John Boyega, whom I'd seen in Attack the Block, and I'm like, that kid is special. Okay. He's going to be a star.
Yeah.
And just loved it, you know. And I saw this, and I'm just looking at it. I'm like, look at that. That's really good, you know. And I'm always so happy to see Ben Mendelsohn in anything.
Now, Ben Mendelsohn is great.
The officer, Orson Krennic.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So, and to see Donnie Yen, and he got to kick ass.
Donnie Yen was good.
Fantastic.
I like Mads Mikkelsen a lot. And whenever seeing Mads Mikkelsen and stuff, I was like, ooh. I just like the cut of his
You just like how he looks.
He looks intimidating. But he's good too. He's a good actor. I like him in it.
What did you think, Kyle?
I'm gonna preface this. Star Wars isn't my life. I don't love Star Wars. Like Star Wars, and some people, Star Wars is their thing. My thing is more like Lord of the Rings. Mm-hmm. I don't love Star Wars like I love something like Lord of the Rings. I also hold a very, very unpopular opinion, and I'm gonna voice it now. And
we're gonna lose all of our listeners.
We're gonna lose all of our listeners.
What is it?
I think that The Force Awakens was just as bad as the prequels. I think it was better than Phantom Menace, but on the same lines as, you know, the Return of the Sith or the Attack of the Clones or whatever. Is that the middle one?
Yeah. Oh.
Kyle, you're entitled to your opinion, even though your opinion is wrong.
Nicole, that's probably the most nicest. Polite way of saying that to me.
We were with friends last night, and
it came up. Claire outed me to a group of friends, and it was bad. I got the whole night. But as far as Rogue One went, I liked Rogue One a lot more than I liked The Force Awakens, and I liked. I mean, it's hard to say, like, oh, it's just as good as the original three, because it's a very different movie.
It's not, but that's okay.
Yeah, it's a different beast.
But it's still really good. Like, the space combat was great. I really like the group, you know. I like their little, ragtag team, I thought was good. And, and the performances were largely really good. There are a couple things that are huge detractors on this film. One of them being... Forest Whitaker, you're a great actor. I'd like to see you in movies, but why was Forest Whitaker in this movie?
I think it was probably a big part.
Why not? I guess that's true. Why not?
Also, there's scenes from the trailer that are not in the movie. I think it might have been bigger in the beginning.
You think his part got cut down a lot?
Mm-hmm, I do.
I just didn't see that he was in, you know, like two scenes, and I didn't really understand the point of him being there. Like I almost forgot that he was in this movie after I walked out of it.
I actually didn't think about it until you just brought it up.
And
it's because it's Star Wars. Somebody offers you a part in Star Wars. What are you gonna do?
Say
no?
Yes.
I'm just, if it's like 3 minutes long.
I just think it was strange. Like that whole section of her visiting him was just kind of weird, and that felt a little forced to me.
Might have been cut down. Felt a little oddly put together.
Yeah, like it didn't mesh with the rest of the movie.
When I was talking about the dialogue and the cuts, that was a lot of my problems were around there.
Yeah.
And I just was a little bit bored. Like,
That and Nicole foreshadowed this before, but the CGI, which was really good, the effects are really great, except for... There's two characters in this movie that are completely CGI, and we're not going to say who one is because it's kind of a surprise. I don't think it's a surprise. I think it's like a nightmare. But the other was Peter Cushing, who played Grand Moff.
Peter Cushing.
Who played Tarkin, Grand Moff Tarkin, in the original Star Wars, who was the guy who kind of oversaw the Death Star. He was kind of the commander of the Death Star, and he is in this movie... As a completely CGI'd person,
you know, I didn't even care.
And
didn't bother me at all.
The first time you see him, he's facing a window, and you see his back, and you see like a reflection of his face in the window. And I was like, oh, this is a tasteful way to shoot this. And then he turns around, and it's like, oh, okay, that's a little uncanny valley, but whatever.
Yeah.
This is probably his only scene. And then they went back to it. And then they went back to it again.
It's creepy. It's really creepy. I thought it was, I don't know if it was 100% CGI or like his face mapped onto a body actor.
I think it was probably mapped onto something.
Yeah.
But I mean, I don't understand why they did it. They cast a different actress to play Mon Mothma.
Yeah. Who looked a lot like her.
Yeah, she looks amazingly like the original actress. This is Genevieve O'Reilly played Mon Mothma for this movie. And in Return of the Jedi, it's played by Caroline Blakiston, I think.
Okay.
So they found an actress that looked very similar and they use it. And I think if they'd found an actor who looked at least somewhat similar to Peter Cushing, people would have accepted
yeah,
that.
Yeah, and make him up a little, you know.
Well, I accepted this.
But
CGI.
I mean, he is very distinctive looking.
Yeah, he is.
That's the only problem with that.
But I don't know. Did you get that Uncanny Valley thing looking at him, Nicole?
Oh, God, yeah. Yeah. Yeah, the eyes don't track in quite the right way.
Yeah.
And they can't, you know, it hasn't quite, the technology isn't quite to the point where they can match the way that lips move naturally. There's something like 18 muscles that control mouth movements.
Yeah.
And they haven't got the way they coordinate properly yet.
I mean, he would have been great in a Nathan Drake Uncharted video game. but alongside real people, it really took me out of it, which was a bummer because I was mostly enjoying the film.
Yeah.
That was just very
jarring. It's almost there, but not quite.
It's almost, yeah, that was another thing I thought is it's just shy of being like a really good movie or even just a good movie. I don't know. I mean, it's good. It's good. It's still fun. Like, I did.
No, I recommend this to anyone. Even if you haven't seen Star Wars before, you can watch this and actually probably get a lot out of it.
Yeah. And one of my complaints with The Force Awakens was I thought there was a lack of romance, which I think is, like, an important part of this kind of adventure, you know, storyline. And I think, and there was, obviously, there wasn't a ton of romance in this, but at the end, there is, like, kind of an intimate moment between two characters in the film, and I feel like that's a big part of what The Force Awakens was lacking was intimacy for the large but you get it
in a sense. Like, New Hope had no intimacy, really.
I think it did. Leia kisses him right on the mouth for good luck before they swing across the where the bridge is out,
and then she finds out it's her brother.
I know, so it's spoilers. Claire, come on.
I think everybody knows that one.
Our producer has a funny story. Our producer has a funny story. I'll tell you later about how his nephew's
Star dad Wars spoiled that Vader was Luke's father to his son.
That's just wrong.
That's wrong. But anyway, back to Rogue One.
Nicole, you wanted to mention the actors?
Yes. I mean, I already talked about a bunch of them, but I mean, you know, like I said, I think the performances were so good by almost everybody in this movie.
I agree.
There's an actor named Wen Jiang, who played Baze Malbus, who is the companion to the blind guardian, Chirrut. And he's the guy with the big gun.
Mm-hmm. He's really cool. He might be my favorite in the movie. I loved him.
Yeah, I mean, and saying he really doesn't have a lot of lines. He doesn't have a lot to do other than shoot his gun at things.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. He does it very well, though.
But he still conveys an entire character, and he conveys, like, this long, companionship.
Yeah, he's got a great...
Donnie Yen's character. He just conveys so much with so little.
Yeah, it's great presence. You know, and their, like, buddy combo thing is really good.
Or maybe more than what I have been reading.
Then there was Riz Ahmed, who's also known as Riz MC. He's a British hip-hop artist. He played Bodhi Rook, the pilot.
Yeah, also very good.
Who, again, had a little more to do, but I think really did quite a credible job with not having a lot of acting experience.
Yeah,
and
no,
then
he got
there's
his character
the
part.
Well, no, he was in The Night Before, that HBO show.
Yeah, he was.
Right,
I knew I recognized him
as well.
And he was in Nightcrawler.
The Jake Gyllenhaal.
Yeah,
he's someone who I think he's starting to. Well, obviously, he's getting.
He
lot
did a
of
good job,
now.
like you said, Nicole. He didn't have a ton of lines, but he really conveyed like a character. Like he was a presence in this movie.
Mm-hmm. I really like that.
Right. And then there was the invisible performance, in the tradition of Star Wars movie with the droids as comic relief.
Yeah.
The character of K2SO was played at least in voice by Alan Tudyk.
He did the whole motion capture. He was there.
Oh, he did. Okay. Yeah. Excellent. So it's a lot of my fellow geeks know best from Firefly.
Yes.
Yeah.
So in the Dodgeball movie and about a million other comedies.
He's got great comedic timing. He's in this movie called Tucker and Dale vs. Evil. It's kind of like a silly.
Yes.
It's so, I love that movie.
I've seen that. That's amazing. Yeah. It's both a, it's like a send up of horror, but it's its own sort of horror comedy.
I didn't know that.
It's fantastic.
I didn't know that.
I kind of love Alan Tudyk.
Me too.
Oh, yeah.
I didn't know that he was in this.
What's it called?
Nerd cred? Or...
Not nerd cred, like nerd canon is Alan Tudyk.
Alan Tudyk. Yeah, for sure. For sure. So I think largely we all would recommend this movie.
Oh, yeah.
Yeah.
Despite everything.
Yes.
Despite Claire wishing that no Star Wars would ever be made again because she's a fun killer. And despite my crap opinions about The Force Awakens. and Nicole's largely liked it as well.
Yeah,
so.
I did.
So, yeah, if you get the chance and you want to see, you know, a gritty war movie, even if you don't love Star Wars, I would say check out Rogue One.
Mm-hmm. It's a good time.
It's a good, solid action movie.
All right.
And it just fits so neatly into the timeline.
Oh,
it's like
yeah.
A puzzle piece
it does.
Interlocks.
It fits perfectly into the end.
So. Yeah, it feels good at the end.
Yeah, yeah. Thank you all so much for listening. Once again, I'm Kyle Willoughby.
And I'm Claire White.
And we are Dragons, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Feel free to contact us on our website at dsrapodcast.com, and we would love it if you could rate and review us on iTunes. You can find the show on Twitter at DSRA Podcast. I can be found on Twitter at Klex303. That's K-L-E-X-303.
You can find me at Along With Claire. That's C-L-A-I-R-E.
And you can find our producer, James, at James Fowey Jr. That's James Fowey, F-O-U-H-E-Y-J-R. Nicole, give us a rundown of your Twitter information and GCS as well, because it really is a great podcast. I recommend people checking it out.
Okay, well, you can find, you can download or stream Geek Cinema Society at the blazingcariboustudios.com website. You can find us on Facebook at facebook.com/Geek Cinema Society. We tweet and are at Geek Cinema SOC. And you could follow me personally on Twitter under at Your Word Wiz. That's YourWordWhiz.
And once again, Nicole, thank you so much for coming on the show.
It was so great to have you.
Oh, thank you for having me. I had a great time.
Yay.
You can learn more about our topic on our Facebook page, which is Rogue One, where we'll post some of our show notes.
We'll also link to Geek Cinema Society.
Yeah, we'll also send a link out to Geek Cinema Society. Our producer, who is the human version of Admiral Akbar, is James Fowey. Our logo was done by Patty Hyland, who I think may have played Darth Vader in this film, but I'm not positive. And our theme was composed by Pete Rowan, who also, you know, who auditioned for the Cantina band back in the day, but he didn't get it. His head is too big, apparently. Once again, this is Dragon, Sexy Robots, and Adventures in Nerd Manual. Thanks for listening, and we will see you next week.